Hello, everyone. It's Scott Tipps again, and it is Wednesday, of course. It's November 14th, and I am here in Southern California. It's a gorgeous day here. It's probably about 85 degrees, so I hope you're equally warm wherever you are. And I want to tell you, though, that we've been very blessed this time to have a really excellent speaker, highly recommended, Dr. Tom O'Brien, who is with us and has been and is a much sought-after speaker. He's internationally, in fact, and a workshop leader, and he specializes in gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. In fact, he's sort of a, if I can say the word, a Sherlock Holmes for chronic disease and metabolic disorders. He can find the help and the aid that people need. He's really a clinician par excellence in treating chronic diseases and metabolic disorders. And he does it from a really, what's known these days as a functional medicine perspective. That is something that really works and isn't just a cookie cutter type of cure-all. It really fits the person that needs to be helped. I mean, this is true functional medicine at work. Now, Dr. O'Brien holds teaching faculty positions with the Institute for Functional Medicine and the National University of Life Sciences. And I have to tell you, and it comes not just from me, but from others, and Dr. O'Brien's probably too modest to say this himself, but I would count him as one of the most respected, probably highly appreciated speakers. And he has this special passion in teaching many of the aspects, the what you might even call manifestations of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease as they occur. And they occur, you know, not just in the intestinal tract, but outside the intestinal tract. And I hope to hear more about this during this hour. So insensitive individuals, as you should know, and Dr. O'Brien will tell us a lot more, gluten sensitivity can trigger autoimmune diseases, epilepsy, thyroid disease, diabetes, migraines, chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, you name it, it's there. So perhaps one of the most surprising messages is the impact of gluten sensitivity on the brain. That's probably what's, you know, affecting me with my craziness here every now and then. But the dimmer switch that occurs in the brain, especially in children, is one that parents and caregivers would never suspect. And Dr. O'Brien is here today to tell us about that. So with that, I want to, and that's just a small introduction for all that Dr. O'Brien can offer his patients and us today. I want to welcome you, Dr. O'Brien, and thank you for taking the time to be on our show here at TNS Radio today.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be with you. And so you're one of these Southern California guys, huh? And,
well, I am this week. Let's see, if you ask me that question next week, I'll be in New York. And the week after that, I'll be in Europe. So I'm one of these itinerant psychotic liberty seekers,
I see.
And I get around. So, so next time I'll be ankle deep in snow and wishing I were back here in Southern California with these blue skies, chemtrail free for a change, but blue skies. So, anyway, yes. But I super appreciate your making the time to be on the program because I've wanted to interview you for quite a while. So, thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So what, you know, just sort of to start out, to be honest, and, you know, I know this will sound silly because I consider myself fairly educated on health issues and have been taking supplements for ever and a day since I was 17 years old. And I fastidiously read health books and health articles and, of course, edit for the National Health Federation, our Health Freedom News magazine, have done that for years, and have been a food and drug doctor, food and drug lawyer for, well, how long? 30 years almost now. And so I represent a lot of alternative healthcare doctors and practitioners, especially against the medical associations. But at the same time, I have to say I have a hole in my knowledge, which is about gluten, because I'm one of those people. I have A positive blood, and I'm, you know, tall and somewhat thin, and I, slender might be the better word. And I, just eat gluten right and left, and I probably shouldn't do that. So is there really a problem today with wheat in our supermarkets, or is a gluten-free diet something that's just another fad? What would you say?
Okay. Yes, there is a problem. And, this is one of the fads that will not go away, and will be transitioning from fad to just accepted basic science. A couple of basic points, if we can start with. One is the human digestive system cannot digest wheat. The type of wheat that we have available to us in this country today and mostly around the world has been hybridized so many times in the last 50 years that it is nowhere near the type of protein that was referred to in the Bible when they talk about the bread of life or the staff of life.
Really?
And so when people say, it says in the Bible, and I'll say, when I'm on stage, you know, with all due respect, with all due respect, no one on the planet is eating the bread that Jesus Christ ate. Mm-hmm. If you could find that bread, you might be able to eat it. However, your immune system is already defensive against it. So it may, even that might be a problem for you. But if you were to get to children and expose them to that first einkorn bread or the einkorn wheat that was on the planet 2,000 years ago, they might not have an immune reaction. Hmm. But we now know that because the proteins have been so altered by hybridization to get more plant growth per acre of land, so more tonnage of harvest, and that the bread itself, the flour itself is more elastic. Gluten means glue, and it's called the 50-50 rule. In the last 50 years, the gluten content has gone up by over 50%.
Really?
In wheat. Yeah. And the human digestive system cannot break it down. Whether it makes you sick or not depends on how strong your immune system is. And for most people, at some point, their immune system gets overwhelmed because of the toxic world we live in. And the immune system is fighting so many battles from all of the chemicals and in the water and in the foods, the antibiotics that are on the foods. There are so many battles that our immune system has to fight. It gets overwhelmed. And then what happens is called loss of oral tolerance. And when the digestive system loses oral tolerance, meaning every forkful of what we eat, every forkful is either anti-inflammatory or inflammatory. Now, what does that mean for your listeners?
Yeah.
Every degenerative disease that's known to man, diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's, brain deterioration diseases, every disease is a disease of inflammation at the cell level. Huh. Inside the cell's on fire.
Okay.
So every disease. And so the question becomes, irrespective of what the disease is, if you look at it from that perspective, one of the obvious points is stop throwing gasoline on the fire. Whether you have diabetes or kidney disease or cholesterol deposits in your blood vessels or brain deterioration, people say, oh, I'm getting older. I can't remember the way I used to. I'm just getting older. Ha ha. Well, how old are you? 42. I say, I don't think so. The brain is not supposed to be going down at 42.
Right.
But every disease is a disease of inflammation. So we want an anti-inflammatory lifestyle. And when you lose oral tolerance, meaning this food that's coming in is not good for us, but the immune system in the gut says, it's okay. It can pass by. Let it pass. Let it pass. At some point, it's been working so hard, it stops saying it's okay, then you begin having a reaction to gluten. And every human is vulnerable to that mechanism.
Well, it sounds like something that, you know, I should have been paying more attention to. So what kind of foods are the highest in gluten content? I know you mentioned wheat. What about corn and rye or other grains like that? I assume it's mostly found in grains.
Yes, and that's a really interesting question that you bring up early in the show, because actually gluten is not bad for you. Oh. Bad gluten is bad for you.
Oh, bad gluten. Okay. I didn't know there was a good and a bad gluten, but that's interesting. Okay. So what is the, what's the good gluten and what is, what would be the bad gluten?
The bad glutens are in the family of glutens that are wheat, rye, and barley. Those are the ones that can stimulate the immune reaction quite easily. Now, someone may be allergic to corn. Someone might be allergic to avocado. Someone might be allergic to tomatoes. One can have a reaction to anything. In terms of the discussion of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease, the grains in discussion here are wheat, rye, and barley. Once someone builds up a immune reaction to those toxic grains, they are more vulnerable to being sensitive to other grains. They are, but it's a, it's an arm's length connection. It is not directly associated. But for your listeners, there is gluten in rice, there's gluten in corn, there's gluten in quinoa and amaranth. So you don't want to get caught, because if people go gluten-free and they feel better, and then they read an article, someone that says the gluten in rice, they've made, oh my God, I've been eating rice. Have I been killing myself? No, you haven't. That gluten's in wheat, rye, and barley that we're talking about.
Okay. And the good glutens, how are they good for you?
Well, proteins in general are essential to our diet. And you know, even though wheat, rye, and barley are a problem these days, and there's lots of discussion and many, many research papers on it, we also have to keep a perspective here that wheat has saved tens of millions of lives.
Yes, true. Very true. Yeah.
People don't die when they eat wheat right away.
Right.
But if they're susceptible, if they're vulnerable, if their immune system loses tolerance, they develop autoimmune diseases, which eventually will cause morbidity, which is getting sick, and mortality. So the person may die, like my godmother, of liver cancer. But if, for her, it was secondary to this allergy to gluten.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are thousands and thousands of cases like that. And there are many case studies in the literature of the diseases that people develop outside of the intestines when they have a sensitivity to gluten.
Okay. Well, now, are there certain body types or blood types or ethnic types that are more sensitive to gluten than others?
The initial studies that began coming out talked about the Mediterranean cultures as being more sensitive, but we're seeing the rise in the Asian cultures almost as quick as in the Mediterranean cultures. Some African countries are even worse, because they eat a lot of couscous, which is in the wheat family.
They eat a lot of what? Sorry, I missed that.
Couscous. C-O-U-S, couscous.
Oh, couscous. Oh, I'm sorry. Of course. Yes. All right. Mostly the North Africans. Yeah. And very popular. Yeah.
And celiac disease is much, much more prevalent there. But in general, it used to be thought it was just the Mediterranean-based cultures, but now we know African-Americans have a very high incidence of it. Asians are climbing up the scale to coming close to the same frequency, that it's not limited to any particular culture anymore.
Yeah. Okay. And do you find that, well, like someone in my situation, I don't tend to think that there's a gluten sensitivity that I have, but I must have something. Is it related in any way with, say, acid reflux? If someone eats grains and then they notice they get acid reflux, is that a manifestation of gluten sensitivity?
It is. There are many papers, you know, to these types of questions for your listeners.
Yeah.
It's really easy to find out. Just go to pubmed.gov.
Okay.
It stands for Public Medical Information.
Mm-hmm.
National Library of Medicine, and it opens up right onto the search engine. The cursor will be the search engine, and just type in celiac disease and whatever it is that you're interested in knowing about, like GERD.
Yeah, okay.
And you will see, I'm not sure how many studies will come up, but there will be many.
Oh, Thank you. That's a great suggestion right there. But you have noticed there is a connection between gluten intake and perhaps GERD, as it's called.
There's a tremendous connection, and we've had many patients who had been on a number of different medications. They would help, but they couldn't take care of it completely. And then they go on a gluten-free diet, and within a few weeks, just a few weeks, they would notice a tremendous difference and sometimes complete relief.
Well, you know what's interesting, Dr. O'Brien, is you mentioned celiac disease. What really is the difference between that and gluten sensitivity?
Well, that's a really good question. But before I answer that,
Sure.
Went to PubMed here as I'm sitting at my computer and I typed it.
You're fast.
There are 63 studies that come up. 63 different research teams that have looked at the association between celiac disease and GERD. And they consistently find there's a direct correlation. If a person has celiac disease, they have a much higher incidence of developing GERD, much higher. I don't recall how high they go. The numbers that I remember reading in the past is 35%, 37%. There may be some studies that show more than that, but 35 to 37% of the people who have celiac disease will have heartburn or some other manifestation of GERD.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And maybe before we go on, let me ask you, there's gluten in other things, too, like soy sauce, even oats transported in a truck that handled or hauled wheat. And I guess just people notice the incredible increase in energy when you get off of gluten and become gluten free. Is that all true?
Yes, it is. Perhaps I can give you a background of why this is so important. And this will take a couple of minutes, but it's the 30,000 foot view.
Okay.
Meaning that, let me give this example of what I mean by 30,000 feet first. If you're in an airplane and you board and you have a window seat and you're looking out the window and people are still boarding on the plane, all you can see looking out the window is the plane next to you at the next gate, and maybe the baggage claim guys throwing your bags on the conveyor belt going up onto the plane.
Right.
You really can't see much more than that.
Right.
As the plane gets pushed away from the gate, if you're looking out the window, you might think, oh, look, the trees are turning color out there if it's the fall on the runway. Oh, isn't that pretty? Because you got a little view of the runway. Plane starts taxiing out there, and now you see all the way down the runway. You say, oh, isn't that pretty? The trees are lining the runway. It's very pretty, very pretty. Plane starts to take off, and you go up, oh, this isn't just a row of trees. It's a forest. Oh, my gosh, that's so pretty. Oh, look, there's a lake down there. Oh, there's the skyline of the city. Oh, my. And you get up to 30,000 feet, and you can see the lay of the land.
Right.
You can see how it looks. People come into a doctor's office with symptoms. And the doctor who focuses on getting rid of the symptoms, which is what the patient wants, and that's really important to do, but the doctor that focuses there is sitting in the window seat at the gate just looking at the symptoms.
Hmm.
Where do the symptoms come from? That's the 30,000-foot view come from that a person has. Hmm. Rarely do we treat the head for people that have migraines. Rarely. Rarely. Do we treat the joint of a person that has knee pain? Sometimes, so sometimes there's a muscle out of balance and you've got to work it or something, but it's usually systemic. There's a systemic reason for why people have the symptoms they do, usually. There's exceptions, of course, but usually that's the case. So in this world of gluten sensitivity, and why is gluten sensitivity so important? I'm going to take it up to 30,000 feet for a minute.
Hmm.
The number one cause of death in our country, in the industrialized world, so in Europe and the U.S., is cardiovascular disease. Number two is cancer. Number three is autoimmune diseases. Now, they're grouped separately. If you have rheumatoid, you go to a rheumatologist. If you have psoriasis, you go to a dermatologist. If you have multiple sclerosis, you go to a neurologist. Every disease has its silo, if you will, like a corn silo, has a silo where everybody's inside the silo and they're looking at it all and trying to do their very best inside the silo. But when you look at the category of autoimmune diseases, the mechanisms that cause autoimmune disease are very, very similar. And the paper started coming out by researchers in 2005, actually a little earlier. The ones in 2005 really caught the attention of many people. What they showed was that there's a triad in the development of autoimmune disease. Oh, I've got to back up. I have to back up a little bit. Excuse me.
Okay.
New literature that's been coming out for the last 4 or 5 years has shown that cardiovascular disease at its beginning stages, when those pipes are starting to plug up, it's an autoimmune disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Cardiovascular disease is included in the autoimmune family of conditions. What becomes the number one cause of getting sick and dying in the industrialized world? Autoimmune disease. Our immune system attacking itself. So autoimmune disease means the immune system is attacking your own tissue. So autoimmune disease is the number one cause of morbidity, mortality, number one cause of getting sick, number one cause of dying. So what percentage of the population may have some type of a problem with autoimmunity and not really know it yet? If it's the number one cause of dying, percentage is close to 100%.
100%. All right.
Close. Number one cause of dying. Now, and nobody develops atherosclerosis or hardening of your arteries and they die in a day, right? It's over 20, 30, 40 years of slowly plugging up your pipes that this thing happened. And it's the same with autoimmune diseases. But the mechanism, we now know the mechanism. The mechanism is threefold. One, you have to have the genetic vulnerability to that particular problem, whether it's heart disease, brain disease, have the genetic vulnerability. Two, you have to have an environmental trigger that sets it off, kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And three, you have to have something called intestinal permeability, or in slang terms, the leaky gut. Now, the number one environmental trigger is the food we eat. That's the most common, most prevalent thing that's going into our bodies is the food we eat.
Okay.
Number one food that is offensive to the body, what scientists are finding out, is gluten.
Right.
The human digestive system can't break it down. So when we eat gluten, even if it's not making us sick, if we've lost oral tolerance, if we've lost the ability to just let this stuff pass through and not pay much attention to it, and our immune system starts fighting it, we now initiate the development of autoimmune conditions. And when you pull at a chain, it breaks at the weakest link. It's at one end, the middle, the other end. It's your heart, liver, your spleen, wherever your weak link is. That's where the symptoms will start to show years down the road as your body is slowly breaking down that tissue. That's why gluten is so important.
I understand, and it's something I need to pay more attention to just in my personal life, and probably most of our listeners, and some of whom have problems such as chronic fatigue syndrome or ME, and is gluten sensitivity and celiac disease, is it, which I guess we never answered that question about the difference between the two, but are they related to chronic fatigue syndrome?
Goodness, yes. The number one symptom of allergies is fatigue. Mm. There are a number of papers in the literature that talk about chronic fatigue syndrome. People in wheelchairs, I just typed in celiac disease and fatigue. 89 papers come up.
Yeah.
89, and that means 89 different research teams that spent months and months and months looking at whatever they looked at in terms of this and published their papers to show the correlation.
Okay.
Here's a that was published in the medical journal Lancet, and the title of the paper is Tired Legs, a Gut Diagnosis.
Huh. Tired legs, okay. And yet it's linked to the sensitivity to gluten.
That is correct. Now, to your question about the difference between them.
Yeah.
International Celiac Symposium, which was held last year in Oslo, finally they came up with agreement about nomenclature when about the whole area of an immune reaction to gluten. And please use the same language, whether we're scientists, researchers, clinicians, doctors, patients, could we all use the same language, please? Because there's a lot of terms.
Yes.
And so they said the top term at the top of the iceberg is gluten-related disorders. So that's the category of gluten-related disorders. If it affects your intestines in a way that causes the wearing down of the tissue in the intestines called the microvilli, mm-hmm. the wear of that tissue, it's celiac disease. If it manifests in the brain, it might tension deficit or Alzheimer's or seizures. As a matter of fact, 50% of children with drug-resistant epilepsy. And if you're a parent with a child and the drugs don't work, you've been to two neurologists, maybe three, you've tried different drugs, your child's still having seizures, you know how painful that can be.
Right.
If 50% of these children go into complete remission on a gluten-free diet.
Yeah. 50%. That's a huge amount.
Huge. Huge.
Numbers.
That was published in the journal Gastroenterology. That was not published in the journal Neurology. So the neurologists that work with kids that have seizure, they don't read the gastroenterology journals. So mm-hmm. they don't know about this unless the patient asks. Hey, doc, can we just check and see if there's a sensitivity to gluten here? Well, why would you do that? Well, I actually heard this interview with a doctor, and he said sometimes seizures can be caused by that. And there are many, many studies on the association that. Seizure. So anyway, back to the nomenclature. At the top of the iceberg is gluten-related disorders. And if it manifests in the intestines, wearing down the intestines, it is celiac disease. If it manifests in the brain, any of those diseases, it manifests in the gut. Other ways, it could be irritable bowel syndrome. If it manifests in the liver, it could be hepatitis. Or it could be mildly elevated liver enzymes, or it could be liver cancer, like my godmother. Mm. If it manifests in the gallbladder, it could be stones, and you have your gallbladder taken out.
Mm.
Kidney, it's called glomerular nephritis. And there are hundreds and hundreds, there's 19,000 papers on this topic about wheat and gluten allergies manifesting throughout the body. 19,000 papers.
Well, why, Dr. O'Brien, then, do we mainly think of it as a disease of the intestines? That's really strange to me.
Good question. And it's because the first tests that were done that identified this were back in the 1950s. It's called an endoscopy, and they put a tube down your throat and look, and they take a look with a little microscope at the intestines, and they're looking for the microvilli. Your intestines are a tube. Tube's about 25 long. The inside of the tube is lined with shag carpeting. Shag
carpeting, that's good.
Shag absorbs different nutrients. One shag absorbs calcium, the next shag absorbs magnesium, the next one the good fats, the next one the B vitamins. All the shags absorb different nutrients. When you have celiac disease, your shags wear down and you've got Berber.
Hmm.
Now, if you've got Berber, you don't absorb calcium. You get osteoporosis.
Hmm.
No matter what drugs you take, you get osteoporosis. That's why the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2006, they said, we do not hesitate to recommend that every patient with osteoporosis must be checked for celiac disease, as celiac disease could be the cause of their osteoporosis. So I show that study to the doctors in my seminars and say, so docs, if the Archives of Internal Medicine says every osteoporotic patient needs to be checked, which one are you not going to check? You just have to look and see. Great, it's easy to fix. If it's not there, okay, well, you know, we checked and we ruled it off.
Well, Dr. O'Brien, if you say someone does have this problem, and many do, obviously, if they were to stop consuming gluten, would that become shag carpeting in their intestinal tract once again, so to speak?
And it usually does. There can be some complicating situations, and a patient needs a little more testing just for gluten. But in general, yes, the shags grow back. It takes a year to 2 years.
Hmm. Okay. So it is possible to reverse the damage that's been done. Interesting. And I assume this affects children just as well as adults.
That's where it was first diagnosed. So back to that tube, the endoscopy tube,
right,
going down 1950s, and they looked to see, did the shags wear down? Yes, the shags wore down. They took them off of wheat. They went down and looked again. The shags come back. They put them back on wheat again. The shags go down.
Gosh.
I said, well, obviously, this is a disease of the gut. That was in the 90s. If the first test that they had done would have been a tube that went up the carotid arteries to look at the brain, they would have thought it's a brain disease. But the first way that they identified it was by looking at the gut. For every one celiac patient that has gut symptoms. There are eight that don't. They've got symptoms in other parts of their body with no gut symptoms. So it was initially thought to be a disease of the intestines because of the initial diagnostic tools that were available. Doctors have been trained that, so many doctors still think that. But when they read papers that say for every one that's got gut symptoms, there are eight that don't. They've got brain symptoms or joint symptoms or skin symptoms or kidney or liver, because it can affect any tissue in your body.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. I mean, I'm actually, and it's clear that I need to study this problem a lot more, and I can see how it would interact and interfere with other treatments that people are making. So let me see if any of our listeners have questions on the chat line. And I see someone asking or mentioning about a cleansing diet. Is there a particular cleansing diet that you might recommend, or is it just simply to stop consumption of gluten?
Well, there are a number of different diets that are out there, and most of them are very helpful and very successful. A safe initiating trial for a person, both gluten-free and dairy-free, for 1 month.
Okay.
So instead of eating sandwiches, eat rice. You know, instead of having pasta at dinner time, just have a little rice, or there are other grains like quinoa, or use corn tortillas, and just stay away from wheat and stay away from dairy. Anything from the udder of a cow. Eggs are okay. Stay away from anything that, because 50% of celiacs also have an allergy to dairy. So if you keep eating dairy when you take wheat out, you might not get the results. So it's such a high percentage of people like that, that it's worth just trying them both for a month and just see how you feel.
Okay. And how about buckwheat and spelt? Are they gluten-free?
Buckwheat is not in the family of toxic glutens. Spelt is in the wheat family of toxic.
Oh, okay. All right. So spelt's not good then, but buckwheat would be. All right. Well, then with children, I assume that this would, from what you had said before, the gluten sensitivity or the celiac disease would affect their thinking processes, right?
Well, in the Journal of Attention Disorder in 2006, they published a study. They looked at 132 kids, celiac kids, diagnosed with attention deficit. 6 months on the gluten-free diet, every child, every child improved in all 12 markers. Every child, every marker for attention deficit. Does not pay close attention to detail, fails to finish work, interrupts frequently, blurts out answers, can't sit still. All 12 markers improved in every child on a gluten-free diet. Now, if that were a drug, it would be on the front page of every paper in the country.
Absolutely. That's right.
There's no profit in this. So there's no one carrying the banner at the corporate level to get the message out to everyone.
Well, that is actually a shame. But fortunately, you're going around speaking about this and raising awareness. So I really appreciate that about what you've been doing and have continued to do. Now, one thing I don't know, and I should have checked this before the program. Do you have any books or articles on this subject?
Well, thank you. We've got some DVDs. There's a number of articles. If you go to the website is thedr.com.
Okay, that's an easy one. That is T-H-E, and then dr.com.
Correct, correct. And there are many articles there, and you also can to receive notice of new events that are happening, new lectures that are coming out, things like that.
Now, one of our listeners is asking, would the yeast in alcohol be an issue?
Yes.
So that would be so, like maybe in beer or ale or things like that?
It's actually the gluten in beer, but many celiac patients are also sensitive to yeast. So yeast in alcohol be a problem for some people, yes, not everyone. But containing alcohols are a problem for all celiacs or all gluten-sensitive people.
I see. Okay. Well, that makes some sense there. And I assume that cider might be okay.
Yes, I would think so.
Okay. All right. Well, getting back to children then, so this would affect their brains and their performance in school. Does it tend to make them hyperactive? Okay. Go ahead.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is the long name for ADHD. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They can't sit still.
And would it lower their IQ, would you say?
I don't know that it lowers their IQ. It lowers their performance because they can't think clearly. One of the things that happens with this is that 73% of people that have gluten sensitivity celiac disease, 73% of them have a lack of blood flow going into the brain. It's called hypoperfusion.
Hypoperfusion. Okay.
And that's a really good Scrabble word, hypoperfusion.
Yes.
When you have a lack of blood flow going into the brain, you know, that's kind of a cerebral exercise to think of what does that mean. But cross your legs for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Stand up and run. You can't. There's not enough blood in your leg. You have to wait till the blood flow gets back into your leg again.
Yeah.
Give your bagel for breakfast if they have gluten sensitivity and send them to school to learn.
Yeah.
They can't. The circuits just aren't firing. And it's not the child is truant that they're a problem. So many patients will say, let's say put their child on a gluten-free diet. So many patients say that the teacher sent a note home. You don't know what the new drug is you're using with your child, but it's working very well.
Okay.
Laugh because, doc, we took him off all the drugs. Mm-hmm. He's changed the way he eats. But the teachers comment on how much higher performance out of these children.
Okay. And I assume that with autism, it might, and because you touched on that before, that it might be a big help to get autistic kids on a gluten-free diet, right?
It's a tremendous, tremendous benefit, and it's the prerequisite. There's a group called Defeat Autism Now, Dan, Defeat Autism. They're a great group. They educate doctors and patients. There's 1,000, 1,500 people that come to them, many doctors for the doctor seminars and many patients for the patient seminars.
One of our listeners, Dr. O'Brien, was asking, of course, many of our listeners are based in Ireland, Scotland, England, Wales, and they were asked in Northern Ireland. Let me not forget that part of the British Isles. They're asking where they could get tested for gluten sensitivity in Ireland or Scotland.
Yes. Good. Hold on just 1 second.
Okay. Thank you.
There is very accurate. Unfortunately, the testing has been less than accurate for 20 years. If your shags are completely worn down, and that's called total villus atrophy.
Yeah.
Blood tests that are out there are very, very accurate. Very accurate. Mm-hmm. And the studies show they're 97%, 99% accurate. They all say, and doctors need those studies, so they believe in those studies.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you read the paper, the only patients they tested for the blood work was people diagnosed with celiac disease.
Mm.
To receive a diagnosis of celiac disease, you have to have total villus atrophy. Completely.
Yeah.
If your shags are just partially worn down and not totally worn down, the sensitivity of the test goes down to as low as 27%.
Meaning
out of 10 times, it comes back and says there's no problem and there really is a problem. That's called a false negative.
Well, what's the best test to take then?
If you have total villus atrophy, the test is very accurate, and almost all the docs are doing those tests that are very, very accurate if you have total villus atrophy.
Okay.
There is new testing that came out in the U.S. that is soon to come to Europe, very soon, I'm told. The laboratory is Cyrex Labs, C-Y-R-E-X, Cyrex Labs, and the new testing look at 10 different markers for gluten sensitivity, not just one. And the sensitivity is much higher with lower amounts of damage that's been done.
Okay.
Much, much higher. So for those of you who want to know about that, you're welcome. If you email me at thedoctor.com, we certainly will send an announcement out when the tests are available in Europe. And I'm told it won't be very long from now at all.
Okay. Let me see. Someone was asking if unleavened bread makes a difference in gluten intake or sensitivity.
Unfortunately, it doesn't. The protein is the protein.
Okay.
It's also for sprouted breads. It doesn't change the protein structure so that the immune system no longer recognizes it as a foe. It's.
I see. Okay. And I'm sorry, I seem to have lost the other question that was here it is. If having celiac disease or this gluten sensitivity, does it interfere with the vitamin D receptors in the gut? I would assume it would, but
most common category of nutrients that the body does not absorb, the fats. And fat malabsorption is rampant with vitamin D is a fat soluble vitamin, as is vitamin A and vitamin K.
Right.
Many people with gluten sensitivity and celiac disease have very low vitamin D levels.
Okay. All right. And then what about meat? Is there bad gluten or good gluten in meat?
Well, unfortunately, there is. Turkeys, and it's the time of year right now.
Really?
They inject wheat gluten into turkeys to fatten them up.
Oh.
So you really have to read the label. But in the United States, it's mandated that they put that on the label.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. But if they're naturally or organically raised, they should be okay.
No, that's not true. Because organic has nothing to do. Organic just means they were fed organic food, which is excellent.
I see.
Nothing to do with whether they're injected with gluten. You really have to ask the butcher. And he won't know and say, well, please find out. I can't buy your turkey unless I know.
Right. Okay. Good point. Especially like you were saying at this time of year in America and North America, certainly. And this is hugely interesting. And some of the people are even wondering, is there a connection between gluten and MSG? Is that a connection that exists?
Direct connection. There's an indirect connection. I wrote a paper that was published in the Journal of Practical Gastroenterology 2 years ago about celiac disease and reproductive disorders, that there's a much higher incidence of miscarriages, much, much higher. We lose these babies because the mother doesn't know that she's sensitive to gluten.
Yes.
A higher incidence of intrauterine growth retardation, meaning the baby doesn't grow very well and they're born very small. A much higher incidence of premature births, which require heroic measures. And thank God for the technology today that these young babies save. But the impact on reproductive disorders is very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
Men's counts go down. Their sperm motility goes down. Pregnancy rates go down. The likelihood of pregnancy is less if you're a celiac. It affects the bottom line is affect any tissue in your body. Just depends on where your genetic weak link is.
Yeah, okay. All right, so these tests, are they, we talked a little bit about the accuracy of them, but what is as you might call it, the conundrum of celiac disease?
Yes, the conundrum is that people suspect they're sensitive to gluten, they get a blood test, comes back, says everything's fine, but when they go off gluten, they feel better.
Hmm.
How do you explain that? Well, it's the test. It's the wrong test.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would certainly think that as well. And I really appreciate your explaining that, because this is the sort of thing that as I said before, and I'll keep saying, I need to pay more attention to. There are a lot of people out there who are probably in the same boat as I am, who are listening right now. We'll hear the podcast that comes later. And just to repeat for one of our listeners who asked, no, wheat is not okay. Wheat is full of gluten, and whether it's sprouted or it's in unleavened bread, it's the same thing because it's the protein that counts. And this is this seems to be a missing link in health and nutrition. And, you know, I think like so many people, Dr. O'Brien, it's something that I've sort of, I shouldn't say scoffed at, because I knew there were people with problems like that, but at least minimized as a problem in society or in, you know, human populations. But it sounds like almost everyone could be affected to some degree or another. Is that right?
It will shock you, Scott. Shock you do, if you do 30 days yourself. You'll notice it within 4 or 5 days that your body starts feeling different.
I see. Okay. Well, I'm going to start trying.
All right. Well, listener heard it now. He's saying he's going to do it. So it'll be interesting.
To see. You're going to hold me to it. I see. You're very clever there. Okay, let me see. Someone is asking another question, Dr. O'Brien, a little bit esoteric question, but someone's asking about, you know, about MMS, and they're asking about doing an MMS enema for celiac disease. Sorry, you blipped out there. You're what?
I'm not familiar with MMS. What's MMS?
Well, MMS is that magic mineral solution. It's the Jim Humble and some other people, and they have a substance that if you take it a certain way and certain number of drops, you can cure any disease. To be honest, I don't know a lot about it, but many of our listeners really swear by it, and they evidently do enemas, and they were wondering if that would help celiac disease. But of course, as you pointed out, celiac disease isn't just about the intestines, and gluten sensitivity is not just about the intestines. So, but okay.
Answered that I would say to that question. Yeah. This problem may help people feel better. It may put the fire out for a while. It may.
I see. Yeah.
But it's not important, and I mean this with all respect, it's not important how you feel. Mm-hmm. It's, of course it's important, because that's why you went to the doctor and you want to feel better, of course. But what's important is the autoimmune processes that are going on in your body right now that are caused for many people by the environmental trigger being gluten.
Hmm.
There's a test out now, and maybe next time, Scott, we'll talk about this world of antibodies.
Sure, and I would love that. I would love to have you back on. You're such a clear, forceful speaker, and you obviously know what you're talking about. And this is really an area that's been, you know, glossed over and neglected, and it's important. I would love it if you had an article or wanted to write an article for Health Freedom News to get that in. And I would really invite you to, to do that.
Thank you. I'd be happy to do that. Let's just make sure to get that information to me. And I'm happy to, for your listeners, reading the Health Freedom News, there'll be an article in there, but also go to scientificamerican.com.
Mm-hmm.
American, go to March 2007, and the cover story is Predicting Disease with Notkins, who is at UCLA. He talks about the antibodies that are attacking your tissue. What I was saying was that no one gets Alzheimer's in their 60s or 70s. You get it in your 20s or 30s. Hmm. And it takes 30 or 40 years of killing off brain cells before there's so much damage that you start noticing the symptoms.
And it gets
exponentially quicker. You get worse faster. Huh. But the mechanism, scientists have known for a long time that it takes decades. It's a decades-long process that has at least 6 different steps. And the autoimmune process, whether it's going to manifest in your brain or your heart or your kidneys or your lungs or your liver, that's what you need to be concerned about. So doing an enema with some product to try to cure celiac disease and think it's okay to eat wheat, you run the extreme risk that, for example, I did this test on myself for predictive antibodies, looking at 24 different antibodies. I had antibodies to myelin basic protein. That's what causes MS. Cerebellar peptides, which causes ataxia, meaning when you're in your 60s, you can't walk. Right. And gangliosides, which gives you numbness and tingling. I had antibodies to all three. Huh. And I said, this is a mistake. I'm as healthy as a horse. They said, no, it's not. I said, do it again. They said, we did. We know it's you. We did it again. It's no mistake. And I had these antibodies and felt perfectly fine. My brain's functioning really well. Mm. And yet I had these antibodies. Mm. So I'm telling you, the number one cause we started this show with, the number one cause of morbidity and mortality in the industrialized world is the autoimmune process. Your listeners don't know what's going on in their bodies right now because enough tissue has not been destroyed yet to have the symptoms. They may suspect something here or there, right, but it's not bad yet. And now the technology is out there to identify it, and we know how to turn it around. But the first step is recognizing the environmental trigger. The most common environmental trigger is gluten that causes the fire that has this whole cascade effect on you.
Hmm. Now, some people are asking about, because you mentioned dairy and dairy sensitivity, what about goat or sheep dairy products?
Right, good question. It's called the homolog similarity. Mm-hmm. It has to be above 62% to human breast milk to be unlikely to cause a problem. There are only three types of milk that I've ever found that qualify for that.
Yes.
Reindeer, camel, and donkey.
Reindeer, camel, and donkey, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
And in those cultures that raise reindeer, they drink reindeer milk and have reindeer cheese, and they don't have the same kinds of sensitivities that we do.
Reindeer, camel, and donkey. I don't know. That sounds rather exotic to me.
It is here in the U.S., absolutely. But if you go to Norway, it's not.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, if you're up in Lapland and want to have some reindeer milk, that's funny. So, in other words, even sheep or goat, yeah, wouldn't be.
Unfortunately, not. The molecules are still cow milk. Proteins are six times or eight times the size of human breast milk, eight times larger.
I see. Well, I really appreciate this. We're out of time now, and our next host is going to come on. And I really have to say I appreciate your time on this and educating me. And I have to say I've been at basic level on this instead of an advanced level, as I have been on so many other topics. But it is something I would love to have you back on again at some point, Dr. O'Brien, when it fits your schedule. And again, for the listeners out there, we've had Dr. Tom O'Brien on the air this hour, and he is an expert on gluten sensitivity, on celiac disease, gluten in general. And he has a website that I invite you to go to, www.the, and then the abbreviation for doctor, dr, .com. So www.vdr.com. Please go to it. And Dr. O'Brien was kind enough to say if you had any questions, you can go to his website and ask them through the website. Anyway, thank you, Dr. O'Brien, so much. We must go and let the next host come on. But I know that there's a lot more to ask. So I apologize for not asking all the questions that we perhaps should have. But I think we hit the highlights.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you so much. And for those of you who are still on the listening line, please stay tuned for Sean McGuire. He's next, and I will be back next week. What will it be? November 21st, I believe. So stay tuned, and thank you all. Bye.